Hallo, guten Abend. Schön, dass ihr alle da seid. I'm going to switch to English now because we're going to do the conversation in English. Maybe just up front, so we're going to talk now for maybe half an hour, 40 minutes. You're happy to ask questions yourself once we're done. So if you think of something while we're talking, or you already have an idea what you would like to know from Lisa, you have the chance to ask questions. And then at 7, the screening of Sisters with Transistors starts right around the corner of here. So for those of you who haven't seen the documentary that yet and would like to see it, you just have to turn right, and that's where you find the screening. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you.
Lisa, you are a French-American filmmaker, and you're making films, music videos, commercials. You've been working with a lot of fashion companies in your work, but the reason why you're sitting here, or why we're sitting here this evening, is the documentary Sisters with Transistors that you put out 2 years ago, and that is actually narrated by the great Laurie Anderson, who also a couple of years ago performed right above here in the auditorium with a great performance called The Language of the Future. And Sisters with Transistors is a remarkable story of the female pioneers in electronic music whose radical 20th century experiments redefined the boundaries of music. And one of the reasons why this documentary is so remarkable is also that before you made this documentary, large parts of this history have actually gone underrated or are not really part of the canon or of previous documentaries or books on electronic music. So with your background, I'm wondering what made you want to do this movie, and where was the start for you?
It was exactly what you just mentioned, the silence of these women's contributions. I discovered them just by chance in an article, that like a kind of Facebook, you know, one of those things that just appears. And I was just so mesmerized by the images of these women. And then when I started to dig into their stories, I was even more kind of, I was just so moved by the sounds, their life stories, and also just their intelligence, the way that they spoke about sound and music. And I think the thing that really interested me, because I come from a political science background, was this idea that this technology really enabled them, that this technology was a kind of liberating force. So I think that's the thing that really hooked me. But really, it's just the fact that these stories hadn't been told and just how remarkable these women are.
Interesting. So, because that's actually also something that I was wondering. The woman and the artist that you portray, they actually make radically different kinds of music, from classical interpretations or electronic interpretations of classical music to abstract drone music. Is there something in your mind that they have in common beyond their interest in electronic instruments and the fact that they're women?
Well, I think what's so amazing about them is just how individual they are. But I think the one thing that, you know, and this is something that I've thought about a lot, is there such a thing as a kind of feminine sound of electronic music? And I don't think that there necessarily is, and this is, the film shows very well just how different that sound is. But I think the one thing that unifies them is this deep listening. You know, this is one of the things that Pauline talks about, but there's this kind of really active listening in all of their practice.
One thing that I also noticed also in, I'm also teaching music history, is that for a long, long time, maybe even until the 1970s, women in music who were visible, they were very often until then either muses or performers, but they were not necessarily talked about as creators or producers. And that is also something that these artists have in common, right?
It's interesting, even just in terms of my own background, I felt that way. You know, I didn't really feel like a creator. It's fairly persistent and pervasive, that kind of way that we view women as muses, and that's changing a lot now, I think, as well, because we're discovering that there are all of these women in history that did create. But yeah, I think that the way that we perceive women as muses and not as creatives is, it's really, it still really upsets me. But I think that's one of the reasons that I was so drawn to them, is that I really identified with that kind of woman, and I was just so excited to discover it and to kind of, I wanted to amplify their stories.
And something that these women share is also, I have the feeling that they all experienced a kind of double exclusion, in the way that for the kind of avant-garde music that they were making at the time, they were excluded from the music establishment because a lot of people didn't consider this as music or too far out for them to respect it. And then within the small circle of avant-garde music, they were kind of excluded because of their gender or not taken seriously enough.
It's interesting. I don't know, from what I understand, I don't know that they necessarily felt like they were excluded from their peers. I think what they were excluded from was really history and the way that we kind of, you know, that their peers got more attention from the media. But I think that they were all really well respected and really thought of as equals by the peers. But I think it's more the way that history has kind of left them out of the canon. I mean, the fact that all that archive exists is proof that actually people were interested and people did at the time acknowledge how important they were.
And maybe something they have also in common is that they just kept on doing this, right? And that this is a big hurdle to overcome, but that they just kept on.
Yeah, I think they were just really, really, truly passionate. I mean, sometimes, you know, in some of the conversations we had, we heard that these women were married to their music, and I think in many ways, I think they were.
Coming back to the making of this documentary, what was your starting point, or what did you already know about the subject, and then how much did you have to research, or where you had to basically start from scratch?
So originally it was just a few photographs, a little blurb, and then, you know, whatever was on YouTube. And then that really kind of was the start, and that kind of made me realize, okay, their archive exists. And then my process was really, I guess, originally just finding interviews. I just wanted to understand more from them. So instead of, you know, one of the things that I was really keen on doing in the film is really to have them tell their own stories. So I think the fact, once I found interviews where they were telling their story, I knew I had material for the film. And then, of course, then the whole research for archive was, you know, that took years. I was, you know, still filling in gaps, like literally the day before I had to finish the film, I was finding new things. And
there's also probably two different ways you had to research, because on the one hand, there's quite a few artists in this film who are no longer with us and where you didn't have the chance to reach out to them and speak to them. So, and then there are those that you could actually speak to. Could you maybe, I don't know, think about an example to describe a little bit your research process for those artists where you didn't have a chance to speak to them? But then also maybe an example of where you reached out and what the process was actually to finding those women and getting to speak to them.
So it's quite amazing because when I started doing the film, Pauline, Suzanne, Laurie, and Eliane were all still with us. And unfortunately, I didn't get to meet Pauline Olivros, which is one of my, you know, real regrets in life, because I just find her thinking and her way of living and everything about her, I just, so inspiring. But it was kind of amazing because when I reached out to them, they immediately acknowledged that this film should be made. And even Laurie Anderson, who I was thinking, you know, she's never gonna, she replied right away to my email and she was keen on meeting me. So I think that everybody kind of immediately, everybody knew that this film should be made and wanted to participate. And then for the people that weren't, are no longer alive, it was a little bit trickier in some ways. But they were, they haunted me. I dreamt about them. I had conversations with them in my dreams. Like, even though I couldn't actually physically meet them, I was literally in conversation with them pretty much every night for 5 years.
Wow, that's a long time. And Was it in most cases, like when you reached out, was it fairly easy to find contacts for the artists and then also get a reaction from them?
So it was really easy to find Eliane, Suzanne, and Laurie, and I think their emails are still online. I think anybody can find them if you really want to. And then Laurie Anderson, it was a bit more tricky. Like, I tried to reach out to her manager, and they never got back to me, and so I ended up having to kind of find a way to to get her personal email. But and then for Delia and Daphne, the British, they were, you know, that, that was relatively... I mean, I never got to meet anybody for Delia, but Daphne has a foundation, and and then there was a lot of just mainly family, you know, people that were close to them that I reached out to and that I started a relationship with. But, you know, all these things take time. But in the end, we got there.
Okay. I don't know if this is a contradiction to what you were just saying, that everyone that you contacted had the feeling, yes, this is something that I want to be part of, and this is long overdue. But also for this festival here, I put together these three installations that you see on the site, and they deal with the history of electronic music in the 1950s, 60s, 70s in science fiction movies and TV adverts. And a lot of those works are actually by the artists who are in your documentary. And a couple of weeks ago, I also spoke to Suzanne Ciani, who's featured in your movie, and she told me that actually when she started out, she would have wished that she would have been more aware of other women that came before her or were even making music at the same time with electronic music, but she just didn't know. Is that something that you've also heard from those artists, that back in the 60s, 70s, they weren't aware themselves that these peers existed?
Well, I think Pauline, Laurie Spiegel, Laurie Anderson, Suzanne, and Eliane, they were all part of a kind of a small circle of women and of people making experimental electronic music that were, they were part of similar festivals. And but I think it's more that they didn't necessarily know that there were women even before them, or they didn't necessarily know. But
or in the UK, or
exactly in the UK, exactly. So it was kind of But yeah, I think generally what I was surprised to find out is that they did have correspondence and they did know each other.
And the topic of this festival here, Cosmic Awakening, is science fiction, sounds of the future, and music. And I think although your film doesn't explicitly deal with this subject, it still, for me, deals with this subject on two different levels. One, a very concrete level, because there's a lot of female musicians who are also in the documentary who made soundtracks for science fiction movies, from Wendy Carlos to Delia Derbyshire to Bebe Baron. But then also, on the other hand, in a more general way, that these women created the future. They created the sounds of the future, but also the way that maybe we listen to this music.
Yeah, and also the way we make this music. They were really pioneering the way that everyone is making music today.
On the subject of science fiction, do you have a guess or an idea of why these women were especially interested, or maybe not interested, but were also asked to work with in the realm of science fiction?
I think it's just because these, you know, it's hard for us to really imagine just how foreign, how alien those sounds must have been at the time. But I really think that they kind of matched. It was just an unknown, both in the way that they were made, but also the kind of sounds. They were sounds that no one had ever heard of before. So I think it absolutely makes sense that these two worlds collided, the science fiction and the early experimental music.
Okay. I wanted to show three short clips from your documentary, maybe for those of you who are not as familiar with some of the artists, but that you have an idea of what we're actually talking about. Could you start the first clip bit, and maybe we can watch 2.5 minutes or so of it?
Greenwich Village is mostly a state of mind.
The village in the 50s had to be the most exciting, wonderful place in the world. It was unbelievable, like Paris in the 20s. We were married in 48, and Louis' cousin brought us a tape recorder for a wedding present. I think we were the only ones in the country with that machine. We had all the artists in the village coming to us for recording work.
I remember my first birth in water. I sway and float, stand on boneless toes, listening for distant sounds, sounds beyond the reach of human ears.
We started a recording studio. We built almost all the equipment ourselves because there wasn't any to buy.
The great American boy is hard at work, inventing, creating, building something. And the desire to build and create new things is the energy that develops industrious, dependable citizens of tomorrow.
It was exciting because you were building these things and you're experimenting with the electronic medium.
Louis made sounds by overloading circuit boards, which Bibi then processed and manipulated to create music. To the writer, Anais Nin, it sounded like a molecule had stubbed its toe.
And we started working on avant-garde films. That's what this was all about, was the avant-garde. The sense of wonder and awe, the beauty coming from the circuits. I mean, we would just sit back and let them take over.
These circuits are not instruments. They are performers.
We would record everything that came out of the circuits. I spent hours and hours and hours listening to all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, later, you went through miles of tape.
Yeah.
Incredible. And she could hold it in memory.
But
she
also
could remember where to go for a certain feeling in the sound.
Bibi had a formal musical education. She made most of the compositional decisions while Louis dealt more with the technical side of things. The Baron's greatest achievement was with the music for Forbidden Planet. It was the first movie with an all-electronic score.
The pride and joy of that period was in coming up with the music for The Monster. We were just beside ourselves. Suddenly, this circuit started generating the most complex sounds. The dying of Morbius was the actual dying of the circuit.
So one thing that this movie reminded me of, especially in this section with Bebe Baron making the soundtrack for Forbidden Planet back in 1956, that this music was so radical and unheard of at the time that this wasn't even considered to be music.
Exactly.
And this is something that they also struggled with, right? Can you maybe talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. When the film was completed, they didn't end up getting the credit of composers. They were credited as making the sounds, that what they called electronic tonalities. And so in the end, they weren't, they fought for many, many, what she reveals in these interviews, that they fought like really, really hard to get that credit, but they just never... They never accepted it, and it was something to do with the musician unions just being just afraid that that these machines would be taking over their jobs. But what people don't, I think, especially at the time, didn't understand is just how much the musician, the composer actually participated in the development of that sound, and it was really composed. It wasn't just purely made by the machine. It was then slowed down, it was manipulated, et cetera, et cetera.
And in a way, today we take this for granted because yeah. it's so, I mean, it's this is everywhere, but it just also shows how groundbreaking this work was back in the time.
But apparently people, when the monster, you know, when as she's describing at the end, people were so scared, they were jumping in the cinema. I mean, that's how scary these sounds must have been to people. This is, I mean, again, we just take these sounds for granted, but people were really scared. I mean, I'm even scared just listening to them and just thinking about these circuits kind of just, basically what they were doing is they were just, you know, feeding these circuits with electricity to the point where these circuits were just, you know, as she says, mm-hmm. dying. But I also love how she talks about, Louis talks about how these circuits were performers. You know, they really saw these as living entities, and so much of where we're going now, you know, with understanding cybernetics and how that kind of form of thinking is taking its a place in our mm-hmm. contemporary society. They were already thinking about those things and really working with those theories.
And then another example in your documentary is Delia Derbyshire. Can we please see the next clip?
The first stage in the realization of a piece of music is to construct the individual sounds that we're going to use. To do this, we can, if we like, go to these sound generators here, electronic generators, and we'll listen to three of the basic electronic sounds. First, there's the simplest sound of all, which is a sine wave. As you see on the oscilloscope, it has a very simple form and has a very pure sound. Now we listen to the same note, but with a different quality. This is a square wave. See, it's very square on the picture, and perhaps rather harsh to listen to. This is because it has a lot of high harmonics, and that's what gives the corners on the picture. A more complex sound still is white noise. We don't always go to electronic sound generators for our basic sources of sound. If the sound we want exists already in real life, say, we can go and record it. But those basic sounds aren't really interesting in their raw state like this. To make them of value for a musical piece, we have to shape them and mould them. We can get the lower sounds we need from the rhythm by slowing down the tape. And the higher sounds by speeding up the tape. And then all we have to do is cut the notes the right length. We can join them together on a loop and listen to them. And then with the higher notes of the rhythm, again we join them together on a loop and play it in synchronization with the first tape. And over this we can play.
Makes it look so easy, right?
Yeah. And what's also astonishing is, I mean, that more than 50 years ago, Delia Derbyshire kind of pioneered the way that millions of people are making music today, because the idea of recording sounds, then processing these sounds and rearranging and editing them, she did all of this, but today you do it in your digital audio workstation or in your software, similar as movie makers are also doing this
totally.
Today.
Yeah, it's really wild. I think you're going to play the Doctor Who soundtrack, but it took her 40 days. 40 days. This is how long it takes to make a very short clip of music.
I don't know if you actually still have that, the clip, the Doctor Who, but if you do, maybe you can give me a sign if we can just listen to it for 30 seconds. No, we can't.
Okay.
That's okay. But so the.
What's interesting is.
Oh yeah, we can. Yeah. Then let's listen to like a couple of. So that we know what this song is about.
Yeah.
this sound actually gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, but it's really interesting. So the clip that we saw just before of Delia kind of explaining, you know, the process of making sound was really prompted by the success of the Doctor Who soundtrack. It was the first time that people actually liked electronic music. Before then, because it was so much associated with kind of science fiction and things that were kind of scary, people really rejected at the in the early history of electronic music. People really rejected it, but this song, because it's of its beauty and its musicality, people then asked, you know, and then that's when she started to cut, and then she was filmed, you know, for television and explaining to people what and how she made that music.
I mean, just to put it in perspective, this piece of music by Delia Derbyshire was done in 1963. So generally, for example, often people, when they speak about electronic music in popular culture, they name check Kraftwerk as the pioneers of electronic music. Kraftwerk formed 6 years after this song was being made. So this was really, it's considered the first electronic pop hit that existed. And I'm wondering, do you think that one of the reasons why these artists didn't get any credit was literally because they didn't get any credit, because they were largely making work where they were hired from, and where they just, when nobody, yeah, no one knew who made these.
I definitely think that that's partly why no one knows Delia and also Daphne Oram, because yeah, this is what they were doing as a job, but people didn't recognize that that was something, you know, that was being composed.
And you said that Delia Derbyshire was kind of credited as making electronic music sound beautiful, and someone who definitely followed up on this is also Suzanne Ciani. And that's why also I really wanted to include in this festival this presentation that you see here on the middle monitor about the influence of electronic music on TV adverts. And Suzanne Ciani, for years and years, she was one of the most successful music producers for TV adverts in the United States. She recently told me when she was in Berlin that at times she had up to 40, 50 people working for her in the early 1980s. And one thing that struck me watching these TV adverts and the music for them is also that the image that one has of early electronic music in the 1950s, 60s, early 70s is of very serious, very avant-garde music. But when you listen to this music of these TV adverts, of course, I mean, they wanted to sell stuff, but yeah. So they sounded very optimistic. And,
totally. And there's a lot of emotion in her music, and I think this is what was very different from the early electronic music being made by men. It was like kind of more theoretical, and this is like infused with emotion. And I think that's why it sells.
And taking this music also outside of the academic world or of the institutions. So let's then, the last clip that we're going to watch, let it be the one on Suzanne Ciani.
Up until that moment, the electronic music had this promise of a different vocabulary, a different language, a new paradigm, a new way of working. Switched on Bach, the way it impacted the public's consciousness of what a synthesizer was completely retroactive. Everybody thought that these things were about replicating sound. To me, electronic music wasn't about making Baroque music with new timbres. It was a different kind of music. You just had the Summer of Love. Everything we knew was being thrown out. And it was a whole new world. Electronics were part of that world.
What are they?
Oh, these are patch cords. These are the things that route the signal from one little module to another to get the sound. You can patch it a lot of different ways. And the way you patch it will determine what you get. It's like creating an instrument.
Do you know before you put them in what it's going to sound like?
Well, you're always going towards an idea. You know, that's what makes you put the patch cords in certain places.
You know, part of an instrument is what it can do, and part of it is what you do to it.
The other part of music, of course, is the emotion and the personal involvement that a musician gives to his instrument. And that's something that I happen to feel and have with synthesizers. So I play the synthesizer the same way somebody else would play cello or violin.
For a classically trained pianist to turn a back on a keyboard is crazy. It was like learning a new language via the means of cutting out your own tongue.
Yeah, I can sing out of tune and it'll still be in tune because it depends on what I'm playing. This is all the pitch, so you don't have to really be able to sing to do this. So it's great, you know. Hello.
I couldn't get a record deal because the record companies were not interested in a woman who did not sing. Advertising wanted to be on the edge. They were looking for something different. I had total freedom. Nobody could tell me what to do. They didn't know what I did.
The new Clairol Custom Care Curl and Brush.
Atari is going to turn your head around.
Big news from CoverGirl.
There's a whole new Thick Lash Mascara.
Now you know why I wanted to make a film about
you. Yes.
It's just so glorious and her so genius.
Lisa, we have to wrap this up shortly, but... Already at the beginning, you touched on the sense of liberation that music meant for these artists. And maybe you can also say something further about, I mean, a lot of these artists had a very intimate relationship with their synthesizer or with their instrument. For example, Suzanne Ciani with a Buchla analog system that she's been working with all her life, or Eliane Radig with her ARP 2500. How important was that technology or those instruments to these artists?
Well, I think, you know, as I said at the beginning, it really liberated them. It was before this technology, there was no way for women who were composing notes on a piece of paper to get their music out to audiences. And thanks to this technology, it was finally possible. So there's a real big love for the instrument, and there is a kind of, they almost humanize this instrument. You know, it's like the best life partner you could have is somebody who amplifies your voice and who gives you total freedom to express yourself.
And maybe also one of the great things about electronic music instruments and synthesizers that they are more than the sonic capabilities that they have, it's more than a guitar or one piano, because it gives you such a multitude of options and sounds. So you don't have to rely on other people. Like if you're playing in a band or working with an orchestra, you can do this by yourself.
Exactly.
Lisa, so this movie, also that we're going to see, for those of you who are interested, in a couple of minutes, came out 2 years ago in the middle of the, or at the first height of the pandemic. And so it wasn't really shown in cinemas, and then it kind of took on a life of its own, being shown as festivals, on TV stations. But can you maybe share some of the feedback that you've been getting, or maybe some of the stories, what happened to you with that subject after the movie came out?
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, because obviously it was so disappointing not to be able to kind of travel. And, you know, even this talk, it's like one of the first, you know, I've had a few, obviously, over, but so few. So I'm just so happy to, like, I just want to acknowledge all of you, because it feels so good to be in a room with people. But I have to say, thanks to social media, and I'm absolutely not interested in social media at all, but I really did feel the sense that there was a community, and it was just so uplifting, despite like my personal disappointment with COVID, to read messages from young, you know, mostly young women, just thanking, thanking the fact that this film exists. So it was hard on a personal level, but it was also so gratifying to really feel that this film has had an impact in people's lives, and I hope it will go on to, and that, you know, in an ideal world, you should all hopefully one day will experience it in a cinema, because we did a lot of work with the sound, which obviously, you know, you don't get to experience, but yeah.
Is there an artist
that... I'm also really happy it's on television. You know, it's the TV version on Arte is a short version, so it's not the full film, but it just makes me so happy that, you know, somebody just turn on the TV and stumble upon it. And that's how much... That's everything.
Is there an artist that you would have liked to include in the documentary, but didn't because maybe there was not enough archive footage or just because you weren't really aware of them until now?
There's so many. This is a very important point. This is really just the beginning of a larger uncovering. There's so many more women. This is just a small sample. And, you know, it was very limited by the fact that it's a feature. Like, how many people can you tell? The fact that I don't speak any other language other than English and French. You know, so there's so many... I know that there are so many other women. I know that it upsets some people that not more women were included. But so is there one? No, there are many. And I hope that, you know, people will continue to draw attention to all the women that aren't in the film, because there are many.
And then maybe also... Thank you, yes. And maybe also difficult or impossible to single someone out, but as a personal question... is there music that you've discovered over the years of making this film that is still with you, that you still realize that you come back to it and like that you enjoy listening to?
I enjoy it for so many different reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, I guess the thing about this music is it is more than just sound. It's like, it's story, it's emotion, it's, you know, so one thing, no. Many things, yes.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much, Lisa. And let us know if maybe you have any questions for Lisa, or maybe also just comments on what you've heard or what you've seen. Anyone?
My understanding of Doctor Who is it was a radio play. If you've gone on radio before television.
That's not something that's really come up, but you're probably right. I mean, most things started on radio, and then if it... What did you say?
He wrote the music, and Delia was actually also not credited as a composer, although Rob said that she should have gotten her credit, because the kind of sound design that she did makes so much of that tune.
Well, what's clear is that most people have not heard about Delia Derbyshire. So I think in a way, yes, I think that the way that history has been written...
Gender is the only point? No, sorry.
I'm not sure I said that gender was the only point.
And just speaking maybe for me as someone who didn't make this movie but who watched it, for me this is super important, because I mean there are documentaries, let's say, on the BBC Radiophonic Workshop out there. There are plenty of other histories on the history of electronic music out there. It's just that they haven't highlighted the contributions to these artists. Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, I reached out to many, like all the big studios in Sweden here, but there was nobody at that studio when I reached out to them that could help me find women. But I'm assuming there probably are. It's just whether there's archive. Maybe you do know?
No, but I would actually also, I mean, I've investigated a little bit in this topic, and it seems to me, but I don't know everything, and I might be wrong, but one of the key differences between the studio in Cologne and the one at the BBC was that the BBC one actually was commissioned with doing a lot of actual work for the radio and for the BBC television. So a lot of it became popular culture, whereas the WDR studio, where famously Stockhausen, for example, worked at, they were making a lot of experiments, and it was financed by the German taxpayer, but they didn't actually make soundtracks a lot for WDR radio or television. Yeah. Any other?
But you know, I just found out, for example, I mean, the one thing that is problematic about the film, which I totally am aware of, is the fact that it's very Western-based. You know, I discovered more recently that there was a Moog synthesizer in India. And I discovered this because there was a brilliant radio documentary on the BBC about this Moog synthesizer and how it came there and who played it, and apparently there was a woman who made music there. So, but did she go on to have the career that these women had? And I don't know. But the thing that's remarkable about these women is that they really did pioneer electronic music.
And on that note, I also have to admit that was a challenge that I had putting together these installations. So for example, I also, it was important for me to also include science fiction movies and soundtracks for science fiction movies from the GDR, from the Czech Republic and Poland. But my limitations was that I can only speak English and German, yeah. And I'm sure that there's a lot of stuff out there, for example, in Japan or India that was made especially also for advertising, which I'm just not aware of, or I couldn't find any information on. So there's still so much work to be done in all of
exactly.
these fields. So yeah. Also, I think you consider what you did as a kind of starting point and not
exactly.
as the end of a discussion.
Absolutely, yeah.
Any other feedback, comments? Yes.
I would like to commend you for having made the movie and paying attention
specifically to these female pioneers, even though it immediately opens the questions that there must have been many more, and perhaps there will be more parts continuing this documentation. And you know, to the comments before, I just want to say, what's really interesting specifically is that the careers of these women documented had a very unique trajectory because of their gender, and it did not influence the quality of their work, and also just adds to create a German word, Selbstverständlichkeit, that is really wonderful and healthy to see. So I think it's a very important movie. When I encountered Suzanne Ciani for the first time at NAMM, I will never forget. There was a row of performers demonstrating the big Moog synthesizer, and then she came, put her glasses on, and started to work on it. And I've never seen someone with such sovereign, you know, natural, without vanity, just craft demonstrated. And I wish I would have grown up seeing this more, being more exposed to this. So thank you.
But it's just, so also, I mean, thank you for saying this, and that's actually something that I also wanted to say on the subject of gender, because you can only be what you can see. And I think this movie is super important also for a younger generation, because there must be a lot of artists, females, who would never even think about doing this if they don't see that others have come before them.
Yeah.
Did you want to add something? Or no? Was there no? Take the bathroom. Okay. I think if someone maybe can give me the time or an indication, I think we have to stop. Okay. So if anyone has another question or comment, please do. If not, yeah.
Is there an uncut version or on a DVD? Is there like a ton of extras? Or is there a website with a lot of material or links to archives? Or is this film effectively the start of something? I guess that's what I'm getting at.
No website as of yet. We have a website for the film, but for the additional archive, it's not available, unfortunately. It's, you know, lots of licensing questions, and you pay per frame, and it's just, yeah, this is the best we could do. But it doesn't mean that somebody else can't take on that challenge, and I encourage anybody who with an interest to go further than just these women and to publish whatever it is that you find. And I think the thing that's great about a film or a radio is just like, how do you tell a story? How do you bring in people so it's not just a bunch of random archive on a website? Like, I think this is the key challenge, is how do we tell these stories that bring in people that aren't just looking on a website, that just, you know, fall into these stories without necessarily seeking them.
It's actually 2 years ago that I saw the film, so I forgot already, like, some stuff. But I remember this other woman from the UK working in the BBC.
Yeah.
Didn't she start from scratch totally? Like, in her free time, she would go to those labs and get those generators and did something that nobody did before.
Yeah, so a lot of the early women working with electronics were working in institutions, so radio or, you know, universities. And Daphne was working at the Radiophonic Workshop, which was, she actually founded it. And what she would do is, this was post-World War II, and so there were tape recorders, and so she would kind of pull the tape recorders from all the different studios and work at night. So yes, she does describe her process. And I think the thing about Daphne is that she was not so interested in doing commercials and working and composition for a commercial or a film and radio. She was really interested in, I mean, she should have been in Germany. Like, she should have been in an institution that was there really purely for research and experimentation. And that's why I think in the end she ended up leaving the BBC, or she ended up getting pushed out. It's kind of a blurry story. But yeah.
And that's, I mean, also for me, that's why the story that you included on Bebe and Louis Barron is, I mean, this really stands out. It's, I mean, there's also a composer and instrument builder that I included in one of the installations, Raymond Scott. Yeah. And what is unusual about Bebe is that they did this completely outside of any institutions. I mean, as she said, they were probably the first people to own a tape machine in the United States. And for them to do all this, like, instrument building and discovery completely by themselves, it's kind of
And there were also a lot of, like, army surplus stores around. So you could get, you know, circuits and all kinds of weird electronics for very, very cheap. And so, yeah, they pioneered that. But then lots of artists that came later really spent a lot of time kind of building their own synthesizers with this surplus from kind of a strange idea that this music really comes from war, from the instruments used for war.
Yes, because a lot of the technology wouldn't exist without military spend or...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And radio also comes from
propaganda.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know, after this became such a wonderful and inspiring piece, what are you currently working on? What topics fascinated you after that, or what is it you're doing now?
So as I mentioned to you, I'm going to Scotland next month to record women who walk to song. So walking is a technique from the Outer Hebrides, from Scotland, and women would basically work the tweed, and while they were working, it was very laborious work, and while they were working, they would actually sing. And so these songs are kind of very unique, kind of an oral history to women's lives in Scotland. And so I'm going to record that, but I'm very interested in politics and women's stories, and I'm working on a few documentary projects, which I can't talk about yet, and also fiction. So I'm kind of, still music-related things, and then some, political women's stories things.
One more question, maybe? No? Okay. Then you have, I think, something like a 5 to 10 minute break. Then the movie is going to start. Lisa, thank you so much for being here and sharing this with us.
Yeah, thanks everybody for coming. Thank you.